everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2019, and you're listening to episode 112 of Postmodern Realities, Necromancing the Stone. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Arthur W. Hunt III, who is professor of communications at the University of Tennessee at Martin. He is the author of The Vanishing Word and Technopolis. Dr. Hunt has written a cultural discernment apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Necromancing the Stone, The Thrill of Dancing with the Dead, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. Art, it's good to have you on.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Melanie. Good to be here.
Well, I'd like you to explain the title of your article that's called Necromancing the Stone, The Thrill of Dancing with the Dead. You'll have to unpack that for us. So in your article, you describe the growing practice of concerts using music videos of deceased celebrities with actual real-life performers. And a more recent one was, I think, on The Voice, Christina Aguilera performed with Whitney Houston, for example. So what's going on there?
Well, in the article, I was referring to a concert that was produced by a company called Pulse Evolution. What they did, they took Michael Jackson's video image and they projected it on a stage using holographic technology. And then they added real-life performers. They added some dancers, and they just created this venue of entertainment that, I describe as dancing with the dead. But Pulse Evolution, they're into other things. I think they do computer animation for movies and other special events. If you look on their website, they describe what they're doing as making hyper-realistic digital humans for entertainment. They're not even afraid to use terms like augmented reality and even artificial intelligence for what they're putting out there.
Well, I want to tell our listeners that we're kind of on a theme because in a few episodes, we're doing a episode on artificial intelligence. So you'll want to keep tuning in to all of our episodes to unpack a little bit more about this issue. So what is this new technique? Is it just purely entertainment? You just said they kind of, this one company does of various different things. And is that their sole goal, just to entertain people?
Well, yes, I would call it an entertainment company. As far as the type of holographic technology that they used for these concerts, and the article that I wrote makes reference to a concert with Michael Jackson. What they're doing is really putting a twist on an old magician's trick. And so they're employing this technique that had been used for at least 100 years, maybe longer, of using mirrors. It's a technique called Pepper's Ghost. And so what happens in these concerts, a projector casts an image onto a sheet of glass tilted at a 45-degree angle, and they create this illusion that the performer is right there in the room. Pulse produced the Jackson concert for the Billboard Music Awards, and I think they also gave rapper Tupac Shakur a comeback using this same kind of holographic technology. And they had big plans of putting Elvis Presley, Marilyn Monroe, Frank Sinatra into this new type of entertainment with concerts. But I believe, and I was looking the other day, they ran into some contractual problems with other producers. So I think some of these plans were put on the shelf. But I still think that they plan to do more concerts like this down the road.
You're talking about that they do these concerts, and in your article, you say that this kind of performance venue in which these like holographic, you know, concerts take place is really a progression of, you know, the celebrity culture born more than 100 years ago out of the graphic revolution, what you term the graphic revolution. Can you explain a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah, as you may know, my area of interest and research is media ecology. Media ecology looks at how technological change affects the culture for good or for bad. And so this has always been an interest to me. And a larger concern for me has been celebrity culture, which really that's what my article is about. And to think about this, to talk about this, we really have to go back and look at some other things people have said when this all came about. Let me begin just in 1979 for a moment. And I'd like to give you a quotation from the historian and social critic Christopher Lash, who wrote a book called The Culture of Narcissism. And this is what he said in the book. He said, "We live in a swirl of images and echoes that arrest experience and play it back in slow motion. Cameras and recording machines not only transcribe experience, but they alter its quality, giving to much of modern life the character of an enormous echo chamber, a hall of mirrors." I think that's a fascinating quote. He went on to say that life now presents itself as a succession of images recorded by our technologies. If we look at our history of technology, we can think of the photograph and the motion pictures, television, and now we have very sophisticated digital technologies. Now, when Lash said that in 1979, that was 40 years ago. And I sometimes wonder what he would say now if he were to see the kinds of things that we experience and do with our lives. And I know this is sort of going back into history, but I want to go further back in history, if you would allow me, because I think sometimes we only think about the present and we don't realize there's a history to everything. And so you asked me about the graphic revolution. And if we're talking about the graphic revolution, we're really talking about something that began over 150 years ago, and it really began with the invention of the telegraph. And then right after that, photography. Telegraphy broke the barriers of space and allowed information to come to us at the speed of light. I mean, how fast, Melanie, do you think information could travel before the telegraph?
Oh, I don't know. I think it would take, you know, what you'd have to get a horse and buggy or horses, or maybe even slower if it was at the very right. Before, you know, we had wheels walking.
Yeah, I asked this question to my students, and it doesn't take them long to say, well, as fast as a horse or as fast as a man can walk or as fast as a ship. But now, and beginning with the invention of the telegraph, information can come to us at the speed of light. And that's pretty significant when you think about the whole spread of human history. In fact, it's interesting to think about what people said back then when this new technology came about. David Thoreau in his Walden, 1854, said, and I think this is remarkable, he said, "We are in a great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas. But Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing to communicate." And Neil Postman talks about this phenomenon, how that now information since that time just comes to us at very fast speeds. And then you lay on that photography. And one of the first observers of what the world of photography was doing to us was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said as a young man writing for the Atlantic Monthly, he said that all of this proliferation of pictures was very much like what Thoreau saw, which was the just explosion of information. And when you have so much information at your fingertips in front of your nose, then it becomes sort of less important. We begin to trivialize information. Holmes said that in photography, the ability to separate form from reality marked the beginning of a new era where, and I'm quoting him, the image would become more important than the object itself. And it would, in fact, make the object disposable. I think that's very insightful. He used an illustration. He said the photographer would become a kind of hunter of animal hides, competing with other hunters to divest every animal in the forest of its skin. That's quite an image there. And so he says every conceivable object of nature and art will soon scale off its surface for us. Men will hunt all curious, beautiful, grand objects as they hunt cattle in South America for their skins and leave the carcasses as little worth. And so it all began back in the middle of the 1800s, and taken together, the photograph and the telegraph formed what Neil Postman called a dynamic duo in the history of communication technology. And then, as you know, then came other technologies that were not just new technologies, but they built upon the old ones. So every new communications technology builds upon the other. So you have radio, and you have telephone, cinema, television, and now we have the digital screen. So when we're talking about the graphic revolution, we're talking about something that really made a new world. And Postman would say that it gave us a world without much coherence or sense. And he compared it to a game of peekaboo. You know, with kids, we played peekaboo with our children and our grandchildren. It's a game that's sort of entirely self-contained, but it's wonderfully entertaining.
You're listening to Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Art Hunt, who has written a cultural discernment apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Necromancing the Stone, The Thrill of Dancing with the Dead, and it's free online at equip.org. To read more cultural discernment articles, please subscribe to the journal. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe, go to our website online at equip.org. You know, you were just talking about Neil Postman, and I just wonder, you know, he passed away 15 years ago, and I just wonder what he would make of just the explosion, especially since, like, things like the smartphone was invented or released anyway in 2007. But I was watching the other day a YouTube video just kind of talking about how YouTube works, and the person said every single day, 75 years worth of video goes up on YouTube. That's in just one day. I can't even imagine, you know, and all of us subscribing to dozens and dozens of YouTube channels. How can you ever even take in all that information or entertainment or whatever it is that we're on there for? It's just so much volume. You talk about a historian, Daniel Borstein, in your article, and you mention his book, and it's called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo Events in America. So that in his title, Pseudo Events, what is that?
Well, in his book, The Image, A Guide to Pseudo Events in America that you just referenced, and this is written in 1961, and his thesis when he wrote that book was, like other people like Postman and Christopher Lash that I mentioned earlier, these are people who are observing, looking at change, what we call in mediaecology as pattern recognition. And so Borstein says that in a relatively short amount of time, and these are his words, and he begins the book by saying, we are now using our wealth, our literacy, our technology, and progress to create a thicket of unreality which stands between us and the facts of life. And he highlights three areas that we do this. He talks about the way we now gather news, and also the way we travel. And then finally, what we consider to be famous people. So if you let me just for a moment kind of touch on some of these, and especially the last one here. So if we think about the news before the graphic revolution, The way that we reported the news in the past was simply asking, you know, journalists would ask the question, what's God doing? And they would report it. Or maybe, what's the devil doing? Depending on your point of view. But then when the graphic revolution occurred, journalists began not just reporting the news, but they began gathering the news. And they used communication technologies to create circumstances whereby our expectations for what was dramatic could be increased. And so Borstein mentions things like the photo op, the press release, the press leak, and then, of course, we mentioned earlier, photography in journalism. And so you now had pictures in a newspaper, and pictures had a way of dwarfing the exposition of, you know, the text. And he said that a new kind of world opened up in which we had growing expectations for the spectacular. And so when we talk about the word pseudo-event, and that's a word that he coined, the pseudo-event is an event designed to call attention to itself. So if we're talking about travel, just as Borstein points out that news is no longer gathered but made, he also said that we have seen the disappearance of the traveler, a word derived from the word travail, and the rise of the tourist. A tourist is a person who seeks pleasure in a world of contrived experiences, sometimes assembled by a travel agent. And so the traveler of yesteryear was a person who journeyed at great personal risk and expense. It took time out of their lives. But a contemporary tourist is someone who can, for a week or two, have an adventure with very little risk to their personal safety. So a tourist can travel to Mexico and avoid contact with the locals down the street because, well, they can spend all their time in a comfortable American-owned hotel made to look like an exotic foreign structure. And so you go to Disney World, a place where tourists flock all the time to experience multiple fabricated fantasy lands. And we think of this as our reality. In most mid-sized cities in America, you can dine at an Outback restaurant and imagine for 45 minutes you're in Australia. This is really a postmodern phenomenon. It's something new to us as human beings. So the pseudo event is only a copy of the original, and yet it creates an illusion that what we are experiencing is as good as the original, if not better. And so if we're talking about people, famous people, and this is what Borstein calls the human pseudo event, it also confuses the copy with the original. Because of the graphic revolution, here's what happened. The hero, a person once known for their achievements, was replaced by the celebrity, a person known for their well-knownness. You know, Shakespeare said that you can divide great people into three classes. There were those who were born great, there were those who achieved greatness, and those who had greatness thrust upon them. So the hero of yesteryear was a person distinguished by their achievements. And the hero didn't rise to fame suddenly, but they came into the nation's consciousness slowly. But then the word fame, which we once associated with the hero, was actually downgraded with the rise of the graphic revolution because it allowed people to become famous overnight. And so Borstein explains the graphic revolution suddenly gave us, among other things, the means of fabricating well-knownness. And so just as with pseudo-news, pseudo-heroes are sort of just pulled out of thin air.
Well, I think we've even gone beyond that in terms of celebrity because of all these different social media platforms and just the way technology has evolved. The average person can become a celebrity, like what they're calling a media, social media influencer. So it's not just people who are actors or models or musicians or something like that. But it's just, you know, we have some, what do you call, reality television stars that are just famous for being famous.
Absolutely.
We just, you know, watch shows just about, that's why they call them the Real Housewives of fill in the blank city. We just watch shows about wealthy women in other cities and feel like that's a real reality that, that people are involved in every day. So just given all this, I know you addressed some of this in your book, The Vanishing Word, that I mentioned earlier. Do you think, what are the dangers of just this, the suit of events and just kind of the, some of the issues that you've mentioned so far?
Well, I might upset some of your listeners right now for what I'm about to say, because it touches on our current political situation, but I'm going to say it anyway. Before Donald Trump, you just mentioned TV reality shows, before Donald Trump was elected president, he was the star of a TV reality show. Mark Burnett, who had been very successful with the show Survivor, was looking for a character to play a business tycoon type, the star in an urban version of Survivor. And what I'm telling you right now was recently reported in The New Yorker. And so Mr. Trump, of course, he had already been a celebrity of sorts, having published The Art of the Deal back in the 1980s. But when they found Trump, he'd already gone through several bankruptcies, and the Trump Organization was floundering. You know, the article says that when the camera people went to Trump Tower for some filming, they saw all this chipped furniture. But The Apprentice changed all that. The Apprentice turned all of this around for Trump, and it elevated his image and made him a recognizable presidential contender. It made him a recognizable contender. So this is a perfect example of a human pseudo event, in my opinion, that we've been talking about. You might remember that the highlight of the show is Trump saying fired every week. And of course, he needed to look like he knew what he was doing when he said that. After all, the show was showing Trump getting out of helicopters and limousines. And so this piece in The New Yorker talks about one of the editors who worked for The Apprentice. And he confesses that Trump was frequently unprepared for these firing sessions. And he sometimes had little grasp for what competitors on the show were doing and how they had performed. And so the editors had to reverse engineer the episodes to make Trump appear knowledgeable and in charge of the situation. So this is what we're talking about. And this gets back at the nature of the type of world that Borstein was talking about, where we actually prefer the copy to the original. And I guess this leads us into a discussion of the nature of celebrity power.
Well, yeah, you talk about in your article the work of the feminist, well-known feminist, and I appreciate her writing, by the way, an art historian, Camille Paglia, and she has a book called Glittering Images, which actually I own. It's at our house. It's a great book. What is she saying? And she talks about celebrity power. You just mentioned celebrity power. Where is she coming from? And I find her, even though she's has a worldview that is completely opposite from mine, a lot of times I find myself resonating with some of her just thoughts about culture and art and different things like that.
Yeah, Paglia, who is not a Christian, although she was raised Roman Catholic, I've heard her describe herself as a neo-pagan. But I agree with you totally. I think she's made a number of very interesting observations about our celebrity culture, which, by the way, did not begin with Michael Jackson, did not begin with Donald Trump. She makes this observation. She says that our first celebrities were actually rulers of ancient antiquity. These were people that were sometimes worshipped as gods. You mean, think of the pharaohs of ancient Egypt. In addition to being a despot and a god, these people were also celebrated people. I mean, it took an entourage of 20 people just to manage the pharaoh's toilet. There were barbers to cut his hair and manicurists to paint his nails, hairdressers to adjust the royal cowl, perfumers to deodorize his armpits, and makeup artists to blacken his eyelids and redden his cheeks. And what I find fascinating about Payula is how she says that Egypt gave us the first beautiful people. And so somewhere between the pyramids of the Nile and the beginnings of the Greek and Roman empires, this notion of vogue was born. It really did begin with the Egyptians. Payula says in her book, Sexual Persona, she says, Egypt invented glamour, beauty as power, and power as beauty, which I think is a fascinating observation. And so she traces this development of pagan beauty in art, because she's an art historian, from Egypt to the Greek culture and the Roman culture. And so when we study the ancient Greeks and Romans, we learn that they cast their gods on Mount Olympus in their own image. And then they began to emulate them. Zeus and Bacchus were just really big, exaggerated personalities. So the pagan persona, I know, is much more complicated than what I'm saying right now, but and certainly we can find examples of virtue and things worthy of praise in works like Homer's Odyssey. But as I said in The Vanishing Word, with the Greeks and the Romans, art was a vehicle whereby they worshiped themselves, because they projected themselves into their leaders.
I just want to quickly get back to this notion of dancing with the dead that's in your title of your article. Do you think that some of these new performances or performance ventures, you know, with holograms of deceased celebrities and so forth, and they use older music videos and so forth, do you think that constitutes some kind of necromancy? That's why you have that in your title. So I'd like you to unpack that for us.
Yeah, you know, necromancy was something forbidden in the Old Testament. And I thought that using that word was just a way to gain interest for readers looking at the article. I mean, when you think about it, you have someone who is dead, someone who is has left, though, a legacy of video footage. And so you have producers using that and then creating this entertainment venue with real live dancers. So I would say that I don't think that these performances qualify as necromancy in the old sense of the word. I would say that Pulse Evolution made a big jump from what I used to do when I went to Disneyland and watched the Hall of Presidents. I don't know if you've ever done that, but I think, though, that this communal aspect of watching a performer who is post-mortem as if they were really alive is sort of dubious at best. A certain amount of audacity about inserting flesh and blood performers into the memory and video footage of somebody like Michael Jackson, who was really a very talented person. But I think the takeaway to all this is that we should pay attention to these kinds of things. And so we're talking about Christians being aware of what's going on around them. I think in the Bible, and I think in Ephesians, the Bible tells us to walk circumspectly. I think that's a King James word. I like the word. It says, walk circumspectly, not as fools, but wise. Circumspectly, that means looking all around 160 degrees. Not too long ago, I got finished reading a book by James K. Smith, You Are What You Love, and I was really struck by it. And he said that church leaders should be aware of the cultural liturgies that we give ourselves to. I like that term, cultural liturgies, because it implies that we do things day in and day out, that we have patterns of behavior that we do, whether it's going to a concert or going shopping or going to a football game. Now, none of these things are bad in themselves, but all these things sort of add up. And what we do, what we attend to, what we construct patterns of behavior after, these things do ultimately affect our loves. And so, you know, I think that would be the takeaway to this. Again, I'm a mediacologist. That means that we look for pattern recognition. And as a Christian, I think that we need to be asking ourselves, is this something that leads me closer to Christ? Or is this something like being lost in a big house of mirrors? Well, when I'm in a house of mirrors, it's fun to be there, but I want to get out, get my feet back on the ground.
Well, I certainly think this topic has a lot of apologetic value, because I know it's not just Christians that are confronted with these issues, but people who are not religious as well. So I think there's a lot of food for thought for our listeners here. Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Art. So it's been a little bit cold lately. Would you prefer hot coffee, hot tea, or hot chocolate?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have some coffee sitting right here next to me. It's not hot because I've had it since this morning. So I would say hot coffee on a day like today, although it's warmer now than it has been since yesterday.
So are you an introvert or extrovert?
I am both, if that's possible. Since I'm a teacher, I normally have to be extroverted, but I love yesterday I did not teach classes, so I was in here writing and preparing a presentation. So I like that too.
And what is one of your most visited websites?
I like the American Conservative. I follow Rod Dreher quite a bit, and I find what he's saying very interesting.
And how old were you when you became a Christian?
I was 12 when I became a Christian.
Well, thanks, Art, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you, Melanie. It was a pleasure.
Today's guest is Dr. Art Hunt, who wrote a Cultural Discernment Apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Necromancing the Stone, The Thrill of Dancing with the Dead, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. To read more cultural discernment articles, please subscribe to the journal. A subscription is $33.50, and to subscribe, go to our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast.